Pastor Jakeem Splash Law of Drug Discovery Course, 24th November, podcast number 6, in room number 242. Hi, Professor.
How are you doing?
Yes. Right. Yeah, because one of my students had a baby last week, so that's probably why. So how do I? Can I just leave this in one place?
Yeah, you can leave it, but once you are through with the class, just press the stop button, and then I'll do the rest.
Just press the star.
The stop button.
Oh, the stop. Okay, and that will go for 2 hours?
Yeah.
Okay. And if I want to stop for the break, how do I turn it back on?
That's okay. You can leave it as it is.
Okay. All right. Okay. Very good. So it's recording now?
Yeah, it's recording now.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good morning. Getting here today was tough. Let me give you all a chance to download the slides. While we're waiting for Rachel, any questions?
Any questions? Do you know when you're going to be able to give it?
Yeah, I want to read everything this week. My ambition is to get back to draft you by the end of this week.
Okay.
That's the objective.
And if you could do it next Tuesday?
No, I would say end of the grading. So, in other words, I want to give it back to you and give you an opportunity to make corrections. So, to the extent that that happens, you know, I want you to have all the benefit of time. So, today we get to Wyatt v. Levine, which was argued at the Supreme Court earlier this month. Its significance is, I think, best measured by the fact that there were over 30 briefs submitted by friends of the court, and to see those briefs, if you go to the Supreme Court website, you can navigate to those briefs, and it's a who's who. It's a veritable who's who of attorneys who practice in this space. So I want to begin by first spending probably the first hour on the pathway that the courts took to a case called Medtronic v. Lohr, and then just this year, a case called Medtronic versus Regal, which we'll look at the end of this hour. And that sets us up to spend an hour on the two arguments presented, the two briefs presented in Wyatt v. Levine. So, to begin, I want to go back to the stakeholders and stakes chart that we've looked at from time to time during the course. And As I prepared for today, I realized that there are stakeholders that are missing from this chart. Actually, this chart, when I first started to do this chart, it was really simple. There were maybe five stakeholders. And as I delved further and further into the subject each year, I realized that this has to be expanded. So what I realized in going over YFB Levine is that I needed to provide for, and the clicker's not working, so I'll come back to here. I needed to provide for, let's see, what's going on. If you go to the next slide, what you'll see is I needed to provide for plaintiff's bar, state government, and bring those two additional stakeholders in. Because when we add one more state, when we add one more stake to this analysis, what we, and that stake is tort liability, you see that those players have a significant stake. On your screens, you should see that, you should see tort liability in purple on your screens. The projector loses that color, has turned it into blue. So that sets the stage, because we'll see in YFB Levine that the role of state government and the role of a plaintiff's bar in the area of tort liability, of course, is important. At the beginning of the chapter in the case book on this subject, the authors make this point about federal and state law. And the point is that this is an incredibly complex area. I think when we in the next hour, when we look at YFB Levine and in the pathway up to it, we're going to see that. But at best in a survey course like this, the most you can do is survey how state law comes into play. And that's what we'll spend a little bit of time doing right now. And of course, the starting point for any kind of analysis where we're dealing with the interplay between federal and state law is the U.S. Constitution. And there's two provisions in the U.S. Constitution. There's Article 1, Section 8 that we've looked at throughout the course, and you can see that's the clause that gives Congress the power to enact many of the laws that we've been looking at this semester, and that comes from the General Welfare Clause, the Interstate Commerce Clause that's in Article 1, Section 8, and when we were looking at intellectual property, also the Patent Clause there as well. So that's the basis for Congress's power to legislate in this area. Now, at the same time, Article 6, Paragraph 2, which we looked at a little bit, but not in the detail that we're going to look at it now, you've got the Supremacy Clause, which in Article 6, Paragraph 2, generally says that if there's a conflict between state and federal law is going to be the supreme law of the land. With that said, there obviously is still, by virtue of Article of Amendment 10 to the Constitution, the reserve powers to the states. And one of the trends that began in earnest in the late 19th, first part of the 20th century was the movement to unify the state laws. There's an array of uniform laws on various subjects that are reserved to the states by virtue of the Constitution and have been practiced at the state level for literally 2 centuries now. Now, the problem, as you saw as early as the 1780s, after the Revolutionary War, and the colonies had come together as states, and they were operating as almost independent nations, was you needed to bring uniformity in, because with inconsistent laws, there's confusion, inefficiency. They can be used to favor local industry over faraway industry, so it has anti-competitive aspects, which also have a discriminatory side. And for purposes of monitoring and policing industry, inconsistent state laws also make that more difficult. So beginning in earnest, during the first half of the 20th century, there was a movement for uniform state laws. And the concept there is, as you can see on this chart, there's a balancing. Instead of confusion, there's rationalization, streamlining, and simplification. Instead of inefficient administration, you have efficient administration and enforcement. Instead of having anti-competitive type issues to deal with, you promote competition. And by promoting competition, there's a benefit to consumers. Similarly, you're able to deal with the discriminatory aspects, because you're not going to favor one industry or one set of companies within an industry over any other. And finally, from the standpoint of compliance, regulating compliance and monitoring compliance, uniform laws give you a way to do that. So at the end, by having uniform laws, you're able to achieve you're able to achieve industrial expansion. You're also able to promote consumer protection and consumerism. So that was the movement towards uniform law. And within the pharmaceutical industry, we'll see that there was an organization actually set up to promote that, the AFDO. We'll look at that in a moment. I just want to echo Rousseau for a second. Early in the semester, we had a picture of Rousseau and his influence on both Locke and Jefferson, and the impact that they've had on the evolution of drug law. And you can see an echo of that in this quote that's in the casebook, where what we're dealing with, and going back to the stakeholder analysis, is you get a lot of silos, you get a lot of fiefdoms, and the stakes don't necessarily, the stakes are the same, but the interest in the stakes can vary, and you create unnecessary friction in the system that would be better left out of the system. So with that in mind, the AFDO, the Association of Food and Drug Officials, was formed back in the 20th century to make state laws in this area, the sorts of state laws that we've been looking at, more uniform. And you can go, that's basically a picture of their website. You can explore that website to see what they do. But essentially the mission is to, it's the same as the FDA's mission, when you look at that, to improve and protect the nation's health and safety, but it has this further concept of uniform and rational regulation. And in that spirit, there are several dimensions along which uniformity can be achieved. Laws and regulations themselves, the interpretations of those laws, the endorsement of those laws by various organizations like this, and the enforcement of those laws. So those are the dimensions along which you can achieve uniformity. With that said, one of the things that happened in the 20th century is that after the 1938 Act was adopted, in the years after the 38 Act, leading up to the 62 amendments, 41 states enacted legislation that looks and feels like the 38 Act. And in the slide deck, what I presented for you, not necessarily to go over in class because we could be here for the whole week, was a comparison of New York law versus federal law. And the slides that show that come up just after this one. Coming back to the notion of states adopting laws that look like the federal law, while 41 states had adopted the 38 Act, as of the third edition of the casebook, less than a third had modernized it to pick up the 62 amendments. So we're what, 45 years later when the casebook was written, and less than a third of the states had actually picked up the 62 amendments. New York, by the way, is one of the states that did that, and we'll see that in a moment. At the beginning of this chapter, the authors of the casebook present a whole, in notes, they present a whole lot of sources where you can go to read more about the subject. And one of those is this article by Southey about why we want uniform state laws. And what's interesting about this article in particular is its focus on the consumer. And I want to pause there because to a certain extent, Wyatt V. Levine, which is the theme for today, Wyatt V. Levine is really about how consumers of pharmaceutical products are going to be protected. And Southey, writing decades ago, points out that one of the reasons we want uniform law, one of the reasons we want one standard across the nation, is to promote the protection of consumers. And when you look at Wyatt V. Levine and you look at that concept in the spirit of tort liability, you can readily raise questions whether or not that result is really achieved if you just have one law across the nation. So that's why I included this in the slide deck. And it has some relevance to your papers, because to the extent that in a given area that's developing, a particular state wants to take a certain approach to a new medication or a new therapy, and that power is reserved to the state through its powers to practice pharmacy and medicine, does that query whether that uniformity that Southey speaks about protecting consumers actually hurts consumers? Think about that contrast. So here's a shot of the 1953 public health law, the omnibus public health law that's adopted in New York. And if you work through each of the slides that are about to pop up, you'll see that I've compared federal law to state law, and you'll see how much they track. The law of medicine and pharmacy and all of the associated healthcare professions come in New York under what's called the education law in Title VIII, the professions. So that's where you go to find this in New York. And what you see is that in terms of the various aspects of healthcare, first, drugs, biologics, devices, the laws that we've been looking at the federal level, the practice of medicine, the practice of pharmacy, payment systems, intellectual property, public health. You can see that what I've done on that row on the slide is I've created a map for you to show you where, if you were looking at this on the state level, where you would go to find those laws. And as I said, the the next several slides are really to show you that indeed New York has adopted, for all intents and purposes, the same legislation that the federal government has adopted. So if a pharmaceutical company is allegedly in violation of a federal law, and for reasons of resource allocation or political judgments or whatever, the federal government isn't pursuing that company. The Attorney General of New York can do so, and that's exactly what Elliot Spitzer did when he was Attorney General with respect to the class of drugs called antipsychotics. Now, just to illustrate that New York has amended its law to, that New York has amended its law to pick up the 62 Amendment, you can see right there that the Kefauver concept of effectiveness is in the New York law. So New York is one of those states that has adopted the 62 Amendments. And again, I give you these slides to show you that mapping and to provide some basis for that conclusion that New York has in fact adopted the federal system. With that said, what I want to go to is the, and we still have a problem with the clock. So, tell me what time it is right now? Okay, all right. So, there's a number of cases that are cited in Wyatt v. Levine and that lead up to Wyatt v. Levine. And in one of those cases, and it's a case that was in the case book, Justice Marshall offers a map of how you go, how the court, how the Supreme Court goes about figuring out whether or not a federal law should preempt state law and thereby under the Supremacy Clause be the supreme law of the land. So Marshall offers this wonderful map of how the court goes through the process of preemption. And let me pause for a second just to speak about why that's significant. If a patient is harmed by a drug, if a patient is harmed by a drug and wants to bring a state action under state tort law, but the federal laws controlling the safety and efficacy and labeling and manufacture of the drug are deemed to preempt any kind of requirements that the state could add, either through legislation or through tort liability. If that federal law preempts the states, then if you are Mrs. Levine, and your arm has been amputated because of not an act of the pharmaceutical company that put the product there, but because the needle that was put in the arm missed the spot that it was to go to, then under the application of preemption, you can't bring that action in the way in which those actions are brought today. So that's why preemption is so significant. So to figure out whether or not the court is going to allow preemption, Marshall offers this map. And the starting point is to ask the question, in the federal legislation that we're looking at, has Congress, pursuant to Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the power to regulate commerce, which we just saw, has Congress in any way indicated that this law is to prohibit state regulation of particular aspects of commerce that are involved here. Obviously, if the answer to that is no, then you can stop right there because the states have the power to continue what they're doing. But if the answer is yes, then the first question that you have to ask is, well, is the entire field to be interdicted here by federal legislation, and therefore there's absolutely no room for the states, or is it particular aspects of the field? So if it's the entire field, what Marshall has in this map is that you have to make sure that Congress really manifested a clear intent, an unmistakable ordination, to use Marshall's term. And if the answer is no, then again, to the extent that the state is outside the aspect that's being regulated, the state can continue. But if Congress has unmistakably indicated that they're going to regulate this field, then you have to go through yet one more element of the analysis. Is this explicit or is it implicit in terms of what Congress has done in the law? If it's explicit, again, that's pretty easy. If it's explicit, and assuming that there are no other constitutional infirmities, then the state laws are going to fall to the federal law. If it's implicit, and you've got to read it carefully, and there are implications, and it's not so clear, then what Marshall tells you is you have to look at the structure and the purpose. Structure and the purpose of this law to figure out whether or not you're going to go one way or the other with respect to whether the Supremacy Clause will take hold. Stevens, when you read Stevens in Medtronic v. Lohr, which is the Latin case in the case book, you'll see that Stevens uses words like the purpose, and he uses words like structure and purpose, and he offers some further guidance on what's going on in those two decision points. Now, if coming back up to the entire field, if the entire, and again we're using Marshall's map, if it's not the entire field, and it's just aspects of the field, then what Marshall tells you is you have to look at whether the state law in question stands as an obstacle to what the federal government was trying to do. And if it doesn't stand as an obstacle, then, well, if it stands as an obstacle, then again, the federal law will be supreme. And if it doesn't, then the state can continue to practice what it was doing. So Marshall offers us that map in the case Jones v. Rathpack. And it's that map that I think is, as we go through these cases, to try and keep this map in mind to figure out, well, what decision was made at each one of those points to get to the decision in this case. And are the cases consistent with one another? So with that map in mind, let's actually look at the cases. Is it, what, about 8:40 right now? Okay. And just to underscore, as we look at these cases, in most cases, if we go back to the map, If we go back to the map, what we're going to see is that in most cases, because of faulty wording in legislation, and remember, words go back to that very first day of class, the same word can mean different things for different people, we're going to see that most of the cases end up over here where things are argued to be implied, so you've got to go through structure and purpose type analysis, or over here where you've got to figure out over here in the case of we're not going after the entire field, is this particular practice of state law going to really be an obstacle to federal law? So we're going to see that the cases are here where we're dealing with implication, and over here where we're trying to figure out if a specific requirement it gets in the way. That is working now, so that's nice. So let's go through the cases, and these were all these cases, with the exception of the very last case, which we'll talk about, which are covered in detail in the slides. These are in the casebook. So the first case is a case called Plumley v. Massachusetts, and it goes all the way back to 1894, a few years before this. A few years before this, Congress had adopted a law to tax oleomargarine. You know, up until the invention of oleomargarine sometime in the 19th century, if you wanted to spread something on a piece of bread and you wanted it to have a butter-like quality, what you used was butter. Well, sometime in the 19th century, they figured out that by using vegetable oil, you could make something that was like butter. And oleomargarine became very popular, and Congress decided to tax it. And up in Massachusetts, they passed a law that said, look, if you're going to sell oleomargarine, don't be coloring it, and don't be putting it on the shelf right next to butter so that consumers will think, oh, this is just another brand of butter. It has to be clearly labeled as oleomargarine. And that was the Massachusetts state law. And there you can see, to the extent that butter back in the 1890s wasn't a national brand, was sort of a local product, you can see, remember the slide where we were talking about anti-competitive and discriminatory aspects, you know, the Massachusetts law did have that aspect to it. And you had a shopkeeper, you had Mr. Plumley in Boston, I believe, who put the oleomargarine out next to the butter and didn't follow the Massachusetts law, and Massachusetts came down hard on him. And he tried to argue that the legislation adopted at the federal level governing oleomargarine therefore preempted anything that the state could do. And the holding at the Supreme Court, it was a 6-3 decision, was that the congressional goal here was not necessarily to regulate how a shopkeeper presented butter or oleomargarine, but really just to get a tax on the oleomargarine. And as long as Congress was able to still have the federal government get the tax on oleomargarine, if Massachusetts wanted to tell you how you had to mark oleomargarine so that a consumer would know that it wasn't butter, that was fine. So, green, note the color green, because when we look at why be the bean, we're going to stay with that color code. So green in this map here means that the state was allowed to continue to have this kind of law that said you've got to distinguish oleomargarine from butter. So it's now about 18 years later, and when we're in the realm of the 06 Act, so the Food and Drug Act of 1906 had been passed, and it covers, remember that covers not only food for people, but also food for animals. And there were very specific requirements having to do, well, I shouldn't say very specific, there were requirements in the 1906 Act having to do with labeling. Remember, the 06 Act was more a labeling act than anything else. It really wasn't a safety and efficacy act or quality in manufacturing. More, it was more of a labeling act than anything else. And Indiana came along, and Indiana said that, and the case actually speaks in terms of, actually uses the word stuff. We're talking about concentrated commercial feedstock for livestock. And the Indiana law said, look, if you're going to come into Indiana and you want to sell, and you want to sell this kind of product, then we want you to provide us with all sorts of assurances that what you're selling is in this bag. So we're going to impose a labeling, a strict labeling requirement on you. We're going to cost you to buy a stamp, so there's some taxation there. And we're going to ask you to swear that this is all, that everything that you say on the label is in this product, is in the product. So Indiana adopts that law. And again, you had at the lower level, the defendant here that Indiana went after obviously was in violation of this law. And the defendant tried to argue, hey, Indiana, you can't legislate here anymore because the 1906 Act preempts the any kind of state regulation here. And again, the Supreme Court says, no, that's not true. The state requirements, if the state can put into place this mechanism and it doesn't pose an obstacle to the 1906 Act, then we're going to let this stand. So, another case for pro-states' rights. Then along comes McDermott on the screen here. It looks almost like in blue, but hopefully on your screens it's red, I hope. Is it a red color? Good. So, McDermott, we're now up in Wisconsin, and we're talking not about oleomargarine or concentrated animal feedstock. We're talking about canned syrup. We're talking about stuff to sweeten food, sweeteners. And what happened here is that the goods were going from Chicago up to Wisconsin. And the goods started out in a crate that had all of the right labeling on it, for purposes of the 06 Act. But when it got to Wisconsin, the shopkeeper took the canned syrups out of the box and essentially changed the label so that it would be consistent with Wisconsin law, because Wisconsin's label wasn't as fulsome as the federally required label. And Wisconsin went after the defendant here for not complying with Wisconsin's law, and the defendant at the lower level, the petitioner at the Supreme Court, said, hey, what Wisconsin, your law is in direct conflict with the federal law here. Just because it's on my shelf and interstate commerce is over and done with, that doesn't mean that the 06 Act stops. The 06 Act continues while that product is still on my shelf. So I have to comply with the 06 Act, and therefore what Wisconsin is telling me to do is an obstacle to me from complying with the 06 Act, so therefore the state law should fall. That's what the petitioner argued, and the petitioner in this case won. Here's an example where the Supreme Court said, you know what? This isn't like Plumlee. This isn't like Savage v. Jones. Here, what Wisconsin is asking you to do in terms of the labeling is really in contradiction of the federal law. So here, the state law has to fall. So those are the cases just before and just after the 06 Act. Now, the 38 Act gets adopted, and there are a series of cases under the 38 Act. What is it, about 845 right now? 850, okay. So, the first case is Cloverleaf Butter versus Patterson. another butter case. And here, what we're talking about is renovated butter. You know, in making butter, a lot of the raw material for making butter you can't use it. In all other things being equal, you've got to throw it away. Well, sometime before this point in time, people figured out how to use the butter that was otherwise going to be thrown out to make fresh butter, and it was called renovated butter. And the old butter, I believe, was called packing stock butter. And down in Alabama adopted a law to regulate how renovated butter would be manufactured and distributed in terms of labeling. And here again, because of the nature of that Alabama law and its direct conflict with the federal law having to do with this kind of manufacturing and this kind of labeling, again, the Supreme Court in 1942 said, you know what, Alabama, your law is posing an obstacle to the 06, to the 38 Act, and therefore it has to fall. We move 21 years later to 63, and now the 62 Act has been adopted, and the product is avocados. Note that none of these products so far that are the seminal cases have anything to do with drugs, biologics, or devices. None of them have to do. These are all food cases. And note another thing, that none of these cases are products liability cases. It's all state regulation versus federal regulation, and all about food type products for either humans or animals. So in Florida Line, what we're dealing with is that the folks in Florida want to sell their avocados to the folks in California, and for purposes of interstate commerce in avocados, the federal government had adopted certain regulations regarding the shipment of avocados, the picking and shipping of avocados in interstate commerce. In California, in terms of, and one of the things, one of the elements was the concept of ripeness. And in California figured that they were going to take a very scientific approach to this. So they said, in order to know that you've got a ripe avocado, at least 8% by weight in that avocado has to be oil. You know, the avocados, like fruit, go through a ripening process, and oil is produced in the avocado as it ripens. And California takes a really scientific approach, saying 8% by weight. And Florida, the avocado and lime growers in Florida take issue with this, and they bring an action against the California regulation, and what I believe was a 5-4 decision, so a close decision, the court said, look, in this case, we don't think that Congress, again, we're dealing with the structure and purpose aspect of the map, the implicit aspect, because Congress in its legislation didn't explicitly talk about ripening avocados, that in this situation where we're implying whether Congress wanted to regulate this, and we're implying whether or not the federal law is to take precedence, in this case, we just don't see anything, and this, I believe this is Marshall writing for the court, we just don't see anything that suggests that California can't impose this kind of test. And that's one aspect of the decision, but then there was another aspect of the decision, and that's, having said that, there was still room for whether or not asking the question whether or not there was this California statute placed on a burdensome requirement on interstate commerce, so the case had to be remanded to deal with that. But at least as a threshold matter, you couldn't, as a threshold matter, say that that California was preempted. You had to go to an analysis that wasn't provided in the record that was presented to the court. Then we come to Jones v. Packing, which is in 1977, another Marshall decision, and it's about bacon and milled flour. And again, we're in the agricultural state, California. And here, this is an interesting case. You know, as some of you may know, when I mill flour and I put it in, and when I put flour in a bag, and I say that it has a certain weight, there's a certain moisture content in that flour that's going to give it some additional weight. Now, if I put that flour in a dry environment and the moisture leaves the flour, then the flour is going to weigh less by the time it gets to the store shelf to be bought. And what and the federal government had regulations that recognized this. It recognized the science here. But California had this regulation that said no. That if there are 10 ounces of flour here, then by the time that it gets to the store shelf over here, it still has to be 10 ounces. You can't have any kind of variation. And this was a case where the court determined that California's rule really did place a burden on interstate commerce, because if every, from an industrial practicality standpoint, if I'm trying to build if I have a factory in Indiana and I'm milling flour, and I have to worry that California has this different standard for measuring than all of the other states that are more or less following the federal system, then that's going to be an impediment to being able to do commerce in California. So with that kind of thinking, the court found that this statute in California had to be this statute had to fall to the supremacy of the federal regulations here. Okay. All right. So why don't we do this? Why don't we cover these three cases, and then we'll take a break, and that will set us up for Wyeth. So now we finally leave the world of food and animal feed, and we come to the first biologic product case, and it's Hillsborough County, Florida versus Automated Medical Laboratories, and it's 1985. We're down in Florida, and we're dealing with plasmapheresis, the process by which people donate blood and products are generated, blood-based products are generated. So it's 1985. We're in Florida. There's a thing called HIV, which no one has a clue about. We know that you can catch it from transfusions. There's a tennis stadium in Queens named after a great tennis player who died because of a transfusion with blood infected with the HIV virus. So Hillsborough County, Florida decides it's going to put in place a system to try and get at the safety of blood products. And it goes beyond what the Public Health Service Act regulation of blood products does, going all the way back to the Biologic Control Act of 1902, Hillsborough County is going to go beyond what the federal requirements are. And here, the court says, we are going to allow Hillsborough to do this. And the reasoning was that nowhere could you find any kind of statement from the FDA that it would in any way seek to preempt Hillsborough County from doing this. The FDA, my guess, was probably applauding this because it was making their job a bit easier. That takes us to Medtronic v. Lohr, which is the last case. It's the last case in the case book in these readings. And this is a situation where we're dealing with a pacemaker. And pacemakers are what are called Class 3 devices. On the next page after this, actually, I think Yeah, on the next several pages after this, there are some explanations for you to get a sense of what Class 3 devices are all about. And we're dealing with here a pacemaker, which is a problem with the pacemaker, and the plaintiff sues the manufacturer of the pacemaker on a state tort law, a state tort law argument. And note the change here. So we've moved from the world of food to the world of drugs, and medical devices, and biologics, and we've moved from state regulation, state commercial regulation, to state tort liability. So we're shifting gears. So the first thing that you have to ask is, in this realm of tort law and drugs and biologics and devices, do all of those laws that were developed in the context of food and state commercial regulation, does all of that thinking still apply? And I just pose that as a question. I'm not endeavoring to answer it. It probably does make sense to look at what a Class 3 device is. Let's do that, because this will make this case and Regal more well understood. So there are three type. Up until 1976, medical devices had not been regulated at the federal level in a cohesive way. There's a lot of state regulation and a lot of question as to how to regulate devices at the federal level. So Congress put into place three classes. Class 1 devices, there really is no unreasonable risk of illness or injury. And for those, you'd have only minimal regulation. What would an example be? I guess an example could be something as simple as eyeglasses. And Rachel, you've done research. Would eyeglasses be Class 1, you think? Or do you think they'd be Class 2? Okay, so eyeglasses, would think of something as simple as eyeglasses, Class 1. Class 2, potentially more harmful. And we don't want you marketing this without some sort of advance approval. And we want some special controls in terms of manufacture. But not a life-threatening thing. So a Class 2, just staying with the eye concept for a second, a Class 2 device could possibly be something like contact lenses. You know, contact lenses could potentially be a lot more harmful to you than eyeglasses. And then Class 3 would be an intraocular lens that gets sewn into your eye, where if you don't do it right, there's the potential for some very serious damage to the body. Another example of a Class 3 device would be a pacemaker, where you're actually controlling someone's heart with this, and if it doesn't work, the patient's going to die. So the concept was that with Class 3 devices, you'd have a thing called a pre-market approval, PMA. And a PMA is very much like an NDA. But instead of applying to drugs, it applies to biologics. Well, biologic is BLA, NDA is drug. Instead of having those things, we have a PMA for a device. And in 1976, there was a ton of Class 3 devices already on the market. Just like we saw the problem with new drugs back in the 60s when Congress decided to have drugs be subject to an efficacy test, and the FDA is faced with this huge mountain of drugs that have never been shown to be effective, but now the FDA has to deal with it. In 1976, Congress hands the FDA the same kind of problem, but instead of talking about new drugs, we're talking about devices. So, recognizing that that's a huge issue, Congress says, okay, FDA, if we'll give you time to get to all those devices that are already on the market. And not to give the existing manufacturers an advantage over new manufacturers who want to enter the field, if any new manufacturer wants to come in with a device that's like a pre-76 Class 3 device, we will allow them upon showing you that their device is substantially equivalent, but without going through the entire PMA process, we'll allow that new manufacturer to sell their product. And the application that you file to indicate this to the FDA is called a 510K. So with that said, we can come back to Medtronic Velour. Medtronic Velour was a case of a Class 3 device, a pacemaker, which came into the market after 76 and therefore was deemed to be, through the 510K process, substantially equivalent. So the FDA, and this is a really important point, the FDA never went with the pacemaker in question here, the FDA never went through the kind of safety analysis that it would had it been looking at a PMA for this device. The pacemaker doesn't work, the plaintiff brings state law negligence and strict liability claims, and in an opinion written by Stevens, certainly not a 9-0 kind of decision, in this case, Stevens, on behalf of what may have been a plurality, not in fact a majority, in this case, common law claims will not preempt federal labeling in this case. And there are several slides that you have in the slides following this that excerpt from the Stevens opinion in the case book, how Stevens went through this analysis. Just this year, in February, another case very much like Medtronic Velour came up, but in this case, in Regal, there was some use of the device beyond what the label said, so there were problems with the way the device was used. We're not talking about a pacemaker in Regal, we're talking about an angioplasty balloon, the kind of device that they put into your heart with a little balloon and they inject it with air to expand the artery so that your blood is flowing in your heart. In this case, we were dealing with a product that did have an approved PMA. So the process at the FDA in terms of safety was followed. And here, writing for the court, just this year, Justice Scalia found that, you know what, Regal is really different. Regal is really, really different from Lohr. And Regal, we're not dealing with a substantially equivalent device that hasn't gone through the PMA process. We're dealing with a PMA-approved device. And for a PMA-approved device, we believe that the FDA's process, and Scalia uses the term rigorous process, the rigorous process that the FDA has is such that if we allow juries to second-guess the FDA with respect to safety, we will have an untenable situation with respect to drugs, biologics, medical devices. And with that kind of logic, the court decides that in this case, the state law tort claims cannot stand. They are preempted by the Medical Device Amendments of 1976. Why don't we pause for about 5 minutes? We'll come back and look a little bit more at Lohr v. Regal and then look at Wyeth v. Regal. Is it about 9:05? 9:10. Okay, why don't we pause for 5 minutes and then resume. I do have all of your papers, and I mentioned to Chris earlier that my objective is to get back comments to you all this week. And Heidi had asked a question about due date, and my ambition is to get these back to you by the end of the week with comments, give you a chance to turn it around. I'm happy to go through as many rounds as you want, and the due date would be at the end of the exam period. All right.
Actually, just want to let you know, I made a couple more revisions to the paper, a couple of things, and since I submitted that last updated submission, so I'll send you, hopefully tomorrow, send you a couple more corrections, this new updated version.
Sure.
So it's just nice, it's truly like a couple of notes or something, but I just want to make sure that you got the entire thing, so.
Good. Was the way that I excerpted YFV within the two briefs by providing the whole brief but highlighting those portions that were relevant, in terms of preference, would you rather have cases presented like that that are going to be excerpted, or just the excerpt so that you don't see the language in between? It was helpful.
Yeah.
Because I think my sense is that given the internet and everyone's use of it, my sense is that cases should really be presented going forward like that rather than the cutting and pasting. Exactly. Good. You know, in an era where you're only dealing with printed matter, it's impossible to do that. But if it's all electronic, you can do that sort of thing. Just before we get to YFV Levine, I just want to go over some quick slides on Lohr and Riegel, just to underscore some of the things that I said quickly at the end of the last hour. First thing, in Medtronic v. Lohr, and I don't know if this made it into the casebook because I was actually reading the case when I was preparing and saw this. Here's a wonderful paragraph from the actual case that illustrates the point that I was making about the FDA being given a new gift in 1976, much like the gift that they were given in 62, an incredible mountain of product that they had to do a full safety analysis on, and just without the resources, with the classic traditional scarcity of resources, how is the FDA going to handle this? These numbers are huge, and you can see that in this slide. In 1983, for instance, a House report concluded that nearly 1,000 of approximately 1,100 Class 3 devices that had been introduced to the market since 76 were admitted as substantial equivalents. Excuse me, I'm getting so excited. Without any PMA review. That's staggering. That's a staggering statistic. But moving on. One of the issues that gets covered in law, and laws are really, there are seven parts to the opinion, and some justices are concurring with some parts, and other justices are dissenting and going back and forth. So really, it was a difficult case, as illustrated by the Stevens opinion and the concurrences and the dissents. So in part six, Stevens says, one of the points that the plaintiffs here made, that the lawyers made, excuse me, is that state common law tort liability is completely not preempted. It falls outside of any kind of preemption. And Stevens in part six says, thank goodness I don't have to answer this question. I really don't want to answer this question right now. I don't have to, so I'm not going to. But Justice Breyer, in Justice Breyer's concurring decision in part, and I believe it's reprinted in the case book, Breyer does say that, and I'm just trying to back up to it. Breyer does say that, indeed, state tort law can be preempted. Under the right circumstances, state law can be preempted by FDA law in this realm. And that sets you up. That sets you up for Regal, because Regal is the case. Regal is the case where, indeed, Justice Scalia, citing the fact that pre-market approval is a rigorous process, and then he tells you about all of the things that the FDA does in order to approve an angioplasty catheter, which is at issue in this case, that fact makes Regal different from Lohr and allows the Supreme Court to rule that the medical device amendments of 1976 indeed preempt state law tort claims. And that's what Regal stands for. So that brings us to the following question. Two questions, actually. Justice Scalia says that the approval process is a rigorous one. And we'll see in Wyatt v. Levine that, as Justice Scalia said, that is the case for devices. The petitioner in Wyatt v. Levine makes a similar argument for drugs. In fact, this drug, Phenergen, which is at issue in Wyatt v. Levine. And so the question becomes, is that process, think back to the central drug safety limit theorem that we looked at weeks and weeks ago, and think about the fact that in the end, we're really just all people, and people make mistakes, and drugs get approved, which have to be taken from the market at some point because you gather new information and pause on new information, that concept, because it plays a big part in what we need. That, think of what we looked at in terms of the case of rofecoxib, the COX-2 inhibitor, which had to be taken from the market because of cardiovascular problems. Just because something is approved and goes through a rigorous process doesn't mean that you can't challenge its safety. So that's one aspect that I think you need to keep thinking about, because if Wyatt v. Levine is decided for the petitioner in that case, if Wyatt v. Levine is found to, it reaches the conclusion that indeed federal law preempts state law, state tort law. You have to ask the question, well, to the extent that state tort law helps to assure the safety of the nation's healthcare products, to the extent that that state tort law helps to do that, do we have to somehow make up for that if that's weakened? So that's I think, a really important question that needs to be asked. And the second question that we come to is, Laura and Regal speak about devices. And in the Medical Devices Act, there actually is, as you read in the Laura case, there actually was a provision that suggests, there is actually a provision in the law that says that federal law is preemptive here. And it sets forth the conditions under which that can happen. And Laura and Regal are really an exploration of those conditions. Well, there isn't a similar provision in the part of drug biologic device law that pertains to drugs and biologics. There's no similar device provision. There's no similar provision for drugs and devices as drugs and biologics as there is for devices. So the question becomes, in the absence of that kind of express provision that covers devices, can we imply from the structure and the purpose of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act as amended over the course of years, can we imply from that law that indeed an approved drug, a drug that has gone through the NDA process, or a biologic that's gone through the BLA process, can we imply from that federal law should preempt state tort law? And that's the question that Wyatt V. Levine presents, I hope, as objectively as I can possibly say it. So let's launch into the case. So just as I hope you've done with your papers where you're writing about an approved drug or biologic or device, the starting point should always be the label, the underlying drug. What are we dealing with here? Because we have to understand that, I think, as a starting point, or everything else just doesn't make sense. So here's the label for Phenergy, the drug in question in Wyatt V. Levine. And you can see the black box warning is there. You can see that it talks about warnings having to do with injection. You can see that it talks about age of patient. You can see that there are some issues with this drug. Does it talk about the particular issue that came to pass and the facts that we're about to see in that black box warning? Ask yourself that question. And there's the drug right there. There's what it's a very small molecule. It's a very small molecule. And what it does is, this is a drug that's used to inhibit the action of histamine. Histamine is a molecule that's involved in the inflammatory process. And what this drug does is it keeps one of the receptors, one of the receptors on the surface of cells that receive histamine, it keeps that receptor from working, and therefore is the drug has an antihistamine effect. And that's there from the label. One interesting thing to note, I think if you did a PubMed search on antihistamine, drugs, I think you'd find something like 30,000 articles. This is a very, very well-researched part of biology. And there's what Phenergen is used for. It's used for a whole bunch of things. In our case, the particular indication that it is being used for in Wyatt V. Levine is right here, prevention and control of nausea. That was what it was being used for. And here, we not in the black box warnings, but in the contraindications. Contraindication is that word is where you need to be careful in using this drug, because it's not for these sorts of uses. Shouldn't be used in these sorts of ways. And right here, you see the point that's at play in Wyeth v. Levine. Under no circumstances, this is in the label, under no circumstances should phenergen injection be given by intra-arterial injection due to the likelihood of severe arteriospasm and the possibility of resultant gangrene. When this drug comes in contact with arterial blood, fresh blood, and arterial tissue, you have a problem. And the problem is called gangrene. So there's the warning right there. It is in the label. It is in the label. But that doesn't mean that you can't still inject the drug into the blood system if you're putting it in intravenously, which again is involved in Wyeth v. Levine. And that's there in the label. So what happened in Wyeth v. Levine? Let's look at what happened at the level of the patient. And one of, I think on your slides, this is red and green. What I'm doing now is I'm taking the briefs and I'm putting them side by side to see how the petitioner and the respondent handle the arguments being presented to the court. And as we go through this, and I'm not sure time is going to be permit in class, but when you look at these slides afterwards, note the use of language. We'll pause in a second when we get to the question presented by the case. Note the use of language and the very subtle differences, and not so subtle differences, in the language used by the petitioner and the respondent to address the same thing. That, you know, there's in terms of writing a brief, in terms of the basic practice of law, there's a lesson here that goes far beyond this class in terms of brief writing, litigation. So, Mrs. Levine is suffering from a severe migraine headache, and migraine headaches, I don't know if any of you suffer from them, but they are, they're serious, and patients would do anything to not suffer from them. And one of the tools for dealing with really severe migraine headache is a drug called Demerol. But Demerol has its own side effect of nausea. So often, both Demerol and phenergen are delivered together. And that's what this language from each of the briefs is saying. But notice. Notice that just to, as an example, just to point out the example of a difference in language. Respondent was initially treated with Demerol for the migraine and phenergen for the nausea. Over here, she received an intramuscular injection of the product. So already. The plaintiff's counsel, as respondent here, is telling you about intramuscular injection at the very beginning of the sentence. The petitioner covers it, does tell it to you, but it's sort of almost as an afterthought. After the initial thought. Very subtle difference, but that sort of thing can make an impact. And as you know from reading the briefs, what happened is that the drug did not work. Mrs. Levine had to go back, and when she went back, instead of having an intramuscular injection, they set up an intravenous line, and they actually pushed the Phenergen into the intravenous line to get it into her body quickly, because the quicker it goes into the body, the more relief she'll have faster. Because at this point, remember, she's got a severe migraine headache. She's suffering from nausea from the Demerol, and you want the Phenergen to take effect quickly. In setting up that IV line, what probably happened is that the vein was punctured and the drug escaped from the vein and went into parts of the arm that did exactly what the warning said would happen. Gangrene set in and she lost her arm just below the elbow. This was a woman who played the guitar and performed music for kids, so her whole livelihood was upset. And that's what happened in terms of the facts. So here's where the use of language is really interesting. So at the beginning of any brief to the Supreme Court or any kind of appellate brief, you're going to set up the question that you want the court to address. And as this lawyer submitting the brief, you have some leeway to set forth the question. So what I've done here is I've set up the question from the petitioner and the question from the respondent side by side, clause by clause, to illustrate the subtle differences. And you can see that the petitioner speaks about judgments, prescription drug labeling judgments, not laws or regulations, but judgments. The word used is judgments imposed on manufacturers. The respondent covers that point by just simply talking about approval of a prescription drug. FDA is the same in both. Note how the petitioner is setting those justices up on the court who believe that the approval process is a rigorous one. Remember that quote from Justice Scalia in Regal, that the PMA process is a rigorous one. Right there, you can see that in setting up the question, the petitioner is making reference to a comprehensive safety and efficacy authority. The respondent has nothing to say there. Keep in mind that the respondent had the benefit of responding to the petitioner's brief. Same reference to the underlying law. It's hard to differ there. Same word preempt. But notice this one. This is a really subtle one that I find so interesting. State law product liability claims. You know, let's pause for a second. One of the major questions that our nation is faced with is products liability claims just getting out of hand. And there's got to be some sort of check on this, because it's just getting out of control. So the petitioner makes reference to state law product liability claims. The respondent doesn't talk about product liability claims. The respondent talks about state law failure to warn claims. Notice the difference in those wordings. The petitioner talks about his argument being premised on the theory that, and the respondent speaks about something occurring in the absence of something. The theory is that state law product liability claims should be preempted, premised on the theory that different labeling judgments, again, the word judgment, usually judgment is a court decree, a court decision. We're talking about approvals. We're not really talking about judgments. But different labeling judgments were necessary to make drugs reasonably safe for use. And because the state law product liability claims would result in different labeling judgments,
therefore it has to be preempted. One of the things that if you look in the slides, I'm pretty sure I included as a slide in the Regal case, a quote from Justice Scalia's opinion where he talks about how one of the problems with state product liability is that we substituted for state product liability allows the decisions of juries to be substituted for that of the FDA, and how that's an untenable situation. So the petitioner is making that argument here. This is a reference to that point out of the Regal opinion. Respondent, on the other hand, goes back to the Medtronic v. Moore case, where we're different from Moore, we're different from Medtronic, we're different from Regal, we're different from device here, we're dealing with a drug now, and in the world of drugs there's nothing express, there's nothing explicit in the statute at all. And then finally, what the respondent says is, Hay Pharmaceutical Company, there was a procedure whereby even recent information about this drug and about the gangrene problem could have been more explicit in your label. And what the what the respondent is really saying, though, is that in the state of Vermont, at least in the state of Vermont, this drug shouldn't be allowed to be used like this, which goes outside the four corners. So let's pause here. I think there are three questions. There's three levels of questions that I think YV Levine is getting at. The first level is just this question here, whether there's anything in the drug part of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act that is like the Device Act and allows a court to find preemption. So the first level is there's nothing there that allows that, and moreover, there's a mechanism by which the manufacturer here could have changed the label, but didn't. And then at another level, and a much deeper level, and we'll get to in the last slide, coming back to the whole products liability balancing, there's really at a deep level, this case really represents a struggle in this society as to how we're going to handle products liability for drugs, biologics, and devices in the kind of economic system that we have. How are we going to juggle that? And at that deeper level, it goes far beyond the specifics of whether or not there's exemptive language or a method for changing a label. You know, let's stay with changing the label for a second. We'll come back to it. Quick time check.
9:38.
Okay. So, square one premise of the petitioner is that the respondent's claims, the plaintiffs in the underlying tort case here, are preempted because it was impossible for the pharmaceutical manufacturer here to comply with the kind of warning that the plaintiff thinks should have been on this drug, and being able to comply with the duties under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. What the petitioner is saying is, look, the respondent wanted you, the manufacturer, to change the label to say this drug should never be used for IV push. That's what it should say. And what the manufacturer is saying, look, the FDA approved that under certain circumstances that could be done. So we can't just change the label to say that should not be done. We're not allowed to change the label for that sort of thing. the plaintiff in the underlying tort case, the respondent at the Supreme Court level, says, look, we're not preempted because it isn't impossible for the manufacturer to comply with both the state law tort liability aspects and the federal drug regulatory aspects here. All that the manufacturer had to do was put a warning on the label that said this drug should never be administered in the fashion that it was administered to the patient. And the manufacturer is saying, no, we don't have the authority to change a label like that. And there's back and forth about this thing called the CBE regulation. And the CBE regulation is something that arose last week in the context of FDA, and the question that gets presented here, and let me look for a better slide for illustrating that. Yeah, 76. Let's skip to 76. So so again, let me summarize. The manufacturer is saying, I can't change the label the way you want me to change it so that nurse wouldn't administer the drug that way. I don't have the authority to unilaterally do that. And the plaintiff's counsel says, yes, you do. And this clause is in the Code of Federal Regulations 1470. It's the changes being affected, called the changes being affected clause. The plaintiff says, yes, you do. For information of this sort, you do have the authority to change it, and the FDA isn't going to come after you for doing that. And the manufacturer's counsel takes the position, no, new information only means information that comes into our knowledge after the approval process. And in this case, the agency knew about the arterial exposure problem when they were agreeing to our label. So you can't claim that this is new information. And this is one of the things that the court is probably going to have to deal with, because if you look at FDA, here's the definition of new safety of information in FDA that we looked at last week. And when you parse through that, Notice how it says, that new safety information may be based on a new analysis of existing information. So my question, I don't think the respondent's brief really covered this, and I wonder if it was covered in question and answering, but I think this point is an important one, because the plaintiff is arguing that based on the history of using this drug in other cases, there have been other cases where people have had fingers and arms amputated because of that intravenous needle not working correctly, those sorts of safety signals should have been used by the manufacturer to put a new label on the product that says never use it in that fashion. The defendant is saying, no, I don't have the authority. I don't have the authority to change the label without the FDA's approval. And then the plaintiff comes back and says, that's not true. New information means that you're allowed to analyze stuff that the FDA had when it was was going through the approval method, you're allowed to newly analyze information. So again, I think that this is a question that the court is going to have to face. Just a quick time check. Okay. So the and the briefs. This takes up a lengthy part of the briefs. Another argument that's really interesting, a regulatory argument that stems from the notion that the approval process isn't a rigorous one, is the following. And I don't think the respondent argued this as well as it could have, and I think you guys, having been through this course, could have, is that, you know, the concept of the approval process being rigorous. You know, when was this drug approved? This drug goes all the way back. I'm on slide 71, by the way. This drug goes all the way back to 1955. What kind of system was in place in 1955? Remember, in 1955, it was pre-market notification. If all other things being correct, if you submitted an application and the FDA didn't respond within 60 days to postpone the effectiveness of that application, you became effective. Is this, the pre-market approval, the rigorous process, didn't come into place until 1962. So can you really argue, if you're going to argue that the approval of this drug is a rigorous process, can you, if this was the system that was used, can the respondent say, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with the petitioner. This wasn't subject to a rigorous process. Now, the response from the petitioner, the response from the manufacturer, is going to be, Your Honor, but look at the correspondence. There were decades of correspondence between the manufacturer and the FDA about changes in the label. So they had ample opportunity to study the safety of this over the decades. So that argument about this drug being approved when it was first approved under the old pre-market notification is hollow. Another question that the case presents that it'll be interesting to see how the court addresses that. Then the coming to this third question, and the overarching question, and going to the last two slides in the deck. You going to that overall balance concept, you can see that the two sides do address this. The petitioner says the court has made clear that where federal law strikes a balance between competing objectives, that is not a judgment the states may second guess. The balance has to swing to the federal government. This goes to the essence of what I think Justice Scalia is saying in Riegel, that we've reached a moment in our evolution. We've reached a moment in the history of drug biologic device law where all of those arguments that were made in the beginning of the 20th century about uniformity of law, we have to pay attention to those arguments. And the way we're going to achieve that uniformity is at the federal level. and you can see that the petitioner is speaking to that. The respondent, on the other hand, I don't think the respondent really addresses that point well, because they continue to argue. They continue to argue, look, there's no reason why the state law tort liability can't sit side by side with the federal system. We're not asking the manufacturer to change the label now. We're not seeking to enjoin the manufacturer from using the label. We're just asking for damages. We're just asking for damages by virtue of the fact that it's there and it says what it says. So those two systems can sit side by side. And that's the question that the court is really faced with Wyeth v. Levine. You know, you can argue whether or not the approval process is rigorous, and I think at the end of the day, as we've seen throughout this course, yes, it's rigorous, but in the end, it's subject to the central drug safety limit theorem that we looked at. And you can argue whether or not Wyeth could have made use of the rule that says you can change a label for new information. And you can point to FDA that actually sets up a procedure to do that. You can argue all of those finer points. But I think at the end of the day, what's really being debated here is a much deeper question, and that's the role of state tort or liability and federal preemption of that in the context of the nation's armamentarium of drugs, biologics, and devices. So it's a really, really important decision. Really important decision. Questions? During the break, I was asking about whether or not the mechanism of presenting the briefs the way I did, with highlighting rather than excerpting, was helpful. And the feedback was positive. Not everyone was here, though. Any thoughts? Any thoughts on that mode of presentation? So with that said, and with the clock in my head, I think it's about 10 o'clock. Let's do this. The Regal slides. The Regal slides started about 51. Those were not in the readings. You may find the Regal slides helpful. And again, we looked at this one. And no, I think we covered his comment that we did cover his comment. This is the slide that I wanted to come back to, because that's really to a great extent that's what if Justice Scalia finds for the petitioner in Wyeth v. Levine, and he's given the case to the opinion to write, I think you're going to see language very similar to that, but instead of applying to devices, it's going to apply to drugs.
I guess the case will be decided by April, and stay tuned because it's just such a fascinating case. And I think that as you read through the briefs, you saw so much of the course that we've been covering repeated in those briefs. And they were a great way to have near the end of the course to sort of act as a summary of that sort. With that said, any questions? So have a wonderful holiday. Next week is the last class. And is it December 1st? Class is end December 2nd? So next
Monday and Thursday.
Monday's a Thursday schedule. I didn't appreciate that. All right. So when is our next class? Is this it? This is it. All right. Well, I didn't appreciate that. Let me thank you. And really. No questions at this point. I had a great time with you all, and I know I lectured a lot. I hope that it gave you a good sense of the course. I look forward to reading your papers and communicating by email. Thank you.